God, thank you for your word. And as difficult as a passage this is, Father, I pray that we would hear from you today. Lord, as we kind of go back in time today and discover some of the saints that have gone before us, who have written some things down for our benefit, Father, I pray that you would open our ears that we might hear today. And God, that we would leave this place with a sense of your great love for us. That our hearts would be stirred at the level of our affections, that Jesus, you would loom largest in our life. And God, that we would move in a trajectory and, Lord, move in a movement in the way that Jesus is calling us to. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so we're diving into Ephesians chapter 5. We are getting into this section in Ephesians, which is probably one of the most contentious and divisive topics that we can talk about in church. Over the next couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks even, we're going to talk about the Christian sexual ethics. We're going to define the Christian vision for human sexuality. I bet you are so glad you came this morning. This is why we can't brush over this topic. It's because we live in a culture right now that believes that reality is fluid and you get to define what it means. That's the contemporary self's mentality. It's really that everything that we encounter is really kind of fluid, so the self, our desires, what we want, we get to define what's really real. We say things like, any of us guilty? I've been guilty of saying this. I've said to people, you got to do what's right for you. Anyone ever say that? You got to find your own truth. That's the culture that we live in. We as Christians, we actually believe the Christian vision of reality is that reality is actually fixed. And we don't define it, rather we discover it by way of revelation. That God has a vision for what's really real. He has a vision for what life is all about. And the more we know him, the more we meet with him, the more we know Jesus, who is God in the flesh, God incarnate, the more we come face to face with our destiny. The more we see his vision for what life is all about. So happiness in the Christian vision of life, happiness isn't life that isn't about walking off into the unknown or having the daunting task of trying to define happiness for yourself or trying to figure out what works for you or finding your own truth, but rather the Christian vision of life and happiness and human flourishing is about getting caught up in who Jesus is and going after him and learning to live in sync with him, seeing that Jesus is this true template for what humanity was intended to be. Do you know that the scriptures actually call Jesus the new Adam? He's this new model for humanity. He's the one we're tracing. He's the one we're seeking to emulate. This is what our chapter says today in Ephesians chapter 5. Paul says it this way. He says, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. As Christians, we are called to emulate, to be imitators of God. And then Paul, he gives us this tangible example of what that means. He says, imitate the love of Christ. Walk in his love. Walk in the kind of love that sacrifices itself for the sake of others. Jesus gave up himself for our sake. And when we receive that love, when we feel his love for us, when we experience his love, it's only then that we start to actually want to emulate it. So starting in chapter 4 of Ephesians, we've been talking about why the Christian community is so odd. And I get to call you every single week. I said, Living Hope, you are super weird. You are the weirdest people I've ever met on the face of the planet. But that's okay. It's actually a good thing. That in the church, there should be some obvious, distinguishable differences about the people of God. And the reason why we are so odd is because our outlook for all of life, so when it comes down to things like money or food or sex or relationships or power or race or stewardship or generosity, our outlook for all of life is actually formed by Jesus. His life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension just influences or just speaks into how we're supposed to live our lives. Now, in no other area in our culture is this obvious, distinguishable difference more pronounced and evident than in the area of sexuality. And in the weeks to come, we're going to talk about the strangeness of the Christian sexual ethic. Now, here's the thing. The Christian sexual ethic is so strange and so foreign to our culture that it actually feels like it's alien to our culture. It feels like this sexual ethic comes from a completely different planet. The contemporary self, when they encounter what Christians view about marriage and sex and all of those things, they see us and they say, that just sounds puritanical and regressive. They're saying, listen, we had the sexual revolution to free us from this repressive view on sexuality. If you want to know some of the stuff that I've been reading to kind of help me with this series, because obviously I am not prepared to really preach on this. I am not a master in this area. Probably nor should I be, right? But I've been reading this book called Divine Sex, okay? There's no illustrations, okay? It's a very philosophical book. It's written by a guy named Jonathan Grant. He did his doctoral thesis on it. Highly recommend it. This is what he says. He says, as a society, we have encouraged powerful sexual scripts that shape the narrative world in which modern relationships unfold. So we've adopted a sexual ethic that is now shaping what relationships are supposed to be about. We have, for instance, put our confidence in sex, but lost our faith in marriage. Young people are encouraged to delay settling down while becoming sexually active at ever younger ages. Research suggests, this is what was surprising to me, research suggests that for many young people, dating and sex are becoming synonymous. One simply follows the other. Fully, 84% of American 18 to 23-year-olds have had premarital sex. While this figure rises to 95% for all Americans of any age who have had sex outside of marriage. Beyond the realm of real-life relationships, virtual sex, thanks to the wildly successful innovation of online pornography, is flooding into mainstream culture. Pornography is being normalized in our culture. All of this unfolds against a backdrop of failed marriages that for over several generations has undermined the imaginative possibility of marriage as a permanent form of relationship. This cultural environment makes the Christian vision of sexuality and marriage seem naive, unreasonable, or at least unworkable as a real-life philosophy, even for many Christians. As a pastor, I stand before you to say that's actually really true. I sit in my living room with a lot of young adults who listen to the Christian sexual ethic and they say, Dan, that's just not realistic. That is not, that doesn't work. Listen, Dan, this is the real world. It doesn't operate that way. Listen, that may have happened, that may have worked in 1900 when like the next greatest thing is a horse. I don't know. But it doesn't work today. So we have a backdrop of failed marriages, a whole generation of kids, my generation, growing up, watching their parents' marriages fall apart, coupled with the rise of a hyper-sexualized culture that says things like, listen, if it feels good, do it. Don't let anyone mess you around. And then you've got pornography becoming mainstream and normalized in our culture. And now the most crazy and unrealistic thing in our culture, the most foreign and alien thing in our culture, is that sex is for lifelong monogamous marital relationships. Do you see how quickly things have changed in our culture? People are like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Listen, that sounds crazier than polyamorous relationships. Now, this is why I feel so strongly that we need to talk about this. Listen, I'm not one of those guys that just wants to talk about this kind of stuff. I'm like, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to stand here and talk about sex. This just kind of makes me blush, right? Like, I'm the guy who reads the Song of Songs, and when it says breast, I giggle a little bit, okay? I still do. Right? So I don't want to be here, but it is important for us to talk about this because our children are being raised in a cultural storm right now. They're flooded through their phones, through advertisements, through clickbait, through social media posts, through endless streams of visions of the good life. And oftentimes there are all these conflicting visions and they don't actually know who to listen to. And the church has oftentimes failed to give our children the reason why the Christian vision for sexuality is not actually about repressing them or taking away from them, but rather it's about releasing them into true fullness and true joy. See, I grew up in youth ministry, and I sat through a lot of sex talks where pastors with great intentions would say, listen, you got to wait until you're married. And then we'd be like, but why, Pastor Jonathan? And they'd be like, oh, I'm not prepared for the why question. Why did someone say that? And then they say, listen, you don't want chlamydia. That's why. So there was this like fear-mongering that took place. And statistically speaking, when I look at my generation, because I'm kind of in that in-between phase between millennials and Gen X, listen, all of that fear-mongering did not work for my generation. It didn't. Not at all. So what I'm hoping to do today is to give you a bit of a rationale for why the Christian vision of sexuality is the way it is. But in order for us to do that, we actually need to go back in time. And we got to meet a dude named Saint Augustine of Hippo. Okay? We have to talk about discipleship first. In fact, we're not going to even really talk about sex today, but rather we're going to talk about this overarching view of what discipleship is all about. And the reason why we can talk about discipleship and relate it to sexual ethics and sexuality is because even our sexuality falls under the scope of Jesus' lordship. Do you believe that? So look at Ephesians 5, verse 1 and 2 again. It says, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. So Paul, through this letter in Ephesians, over and over and over and over again from chapter 1 to the end of chapter 6, he is always challenging us at the level of our loves. The biggest question when it comes down to discipleship is this question: what do you love? This is why Jesus questions Peter in John 21 when he says, Simon Peter, do you love me more than these? What you love is the most important thing about you. In fact, James K.A. Smith wrote a book called You Are What You Love, and in that book, he talks about the way we live is more shaped by what we love than even what we believe. That it's our desires that actually determine our decisions, it's our affections that fuel our actions, it's our wanting that shapes our walking. In fact, the Apostle Paul picks this up in Philippians. In Philippians 3, verse 18 to 19, he says this. He says, for many of whom I have often told you and now tell you even with tears, walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction. Hear this. Their God is their belly, and they glory in their shame and with their mindset on earthly things. He says their God is their belly. It's these hungers and desires that actually begin to shape our habits and even our thinking. Now, I know some of you intellectuals here really bristle at this idea that we are more shaped by what we love than even what we believe. But let me tell you, when I'm walking by that Cumberland Bakery, when I am walking by that Cumberland Bakery, it's not a matter of what I believe in that moment. It's a matter of what I want. Can I get a witness? Right? Right? I don't know what they put in that glaze. I think it's cocaine. I'm not sure, but like... Now, some of you are saying, look, Dan, I can pass by that bakery all day long. And you're right. I'm weak. I get it. But the reason why some of you can walk past that bakery, the reason why you can do that is that you want health more than you want donuts. Actually, some of you don't even like donuts. And to that I say, get out of this church. Honestly. Right? You're still driven by a want. And the point I'm trying to make is that we are not primarily thinking creatures. We are primarily loving creatures. One theologian put it this way: we are not bobbleheads, we're bobble hearts. That at the end of the day, we are people who are driven by our affections. What you love most is what you will live for. Now I know, we're fickle human beings, aren't we? We often have this hierarchy of hungers going on inside of us. We're constantly rearranging and reordering the importance of these loves in our lives. I remember talking to a middle school girl being like, hey, you like Justin Bieber, right? And she was like, Justin Bieber? That was like 4 months ago. It's all about One Direction now. So in her life, there's this reordering and rearranging of the hierarchy of the loves of her life. And Justin was dethroned 4 months ago. Man, I still love the Biebs, okay? He's dethroned 4 months ago. Now, One Direction has this prime spot in her life, but wait till she meets Drake. Man, Drake is gonna break her heart. So we're constantly reordering and rearranging the importance of our loves. See, there's going to be one North Star. Actually, let me back up one thing. One second. There's always that one thing that has the greatest gravitational pull in your life, more than anything else. And everything else in your life will have to submit to whatever holds that prime spot in your heart. In other words, there's going to be always that one North Star in which you navigate your life, and everything else is going to be dimmer than that one great love in your life. And the million-dollar question this morning is, what is that one thing? What desire, what hunger rules you more than any other hunger or desire? This is what St. Augustine used to teach about. He talked about how we need to reorder our lives. In fact, there was a seminary professor named David Noggle, and he wrote a book on Augustine called Reordered Loves, Reordered Lives, and this is what he says. He says, according to Augustine, there is a scale of value stretching from earthly to heavenly realities, from the visible to the invisible. And the inequality between these goods makes possible the existence of them all. God is one thing, angels are another, as are people, terriers, red oaks, squash, rocks, and dirt. In other words, everything has its place on the scale of being. Each item fits in God's overall scheme of creation. The nature of things in the hierarchy is unchangeable. In other words, a rock is always going to be a rock. Dirt's always dirt. A terrier is always a terrier. And so is the kind... So let me back up. Each item fits in God's overall scheme of creation. The nature of things in the hierarchy is unchangeable, and so is the kind of satisfaction it can provide when we are related to it through love. Because of these actual differences in things, the outcomes of loving each actual thing will be different. There is a divinely designed fit between our needs, the character of the things that can satisfy them, and the way we should love them in order to be satisfied. Even though each thing God has made is good, delightful, legitimate, and a source of satisfaction as an object of our loves, we must not expect more from it than its unique nature can provide. If you get that, if you understand what he's saying here, this is intensely important. In the words of Augustine, he said, we must give love and praise to things apportioned to their worth. So in front of us right here, if you notice, we have actually a small scale of being here. You got a rock, you got a box of pizza. It's empty, so we should probably reorder this, because that's nothing now, right? Got a pair of shoes, we got a laptop, we got some sort of Honda. I don't know what it is. It's a red car. And we've got baby Abigail, right? So we got like a scale of being here. Now, listen, there are a lot of people that just love rocks. They're called geologists. I don't get that, right? I don't get it. I know people that have rock collections. I don't get it. And they get a lot of value from collecting rocks, right? Not judging. I'm just saying they get joy from this. But listen, it gets a little bit distorted when we're deciding that, like, if there's a fire in your house and it's between your baby and your rock and you're choosing your rock collection, right? That's when we actually get repulsed by these disordered loves that we oftentimes operate in, is that we begin to show value to things that are way more than what they're actually worth, right? So a prime example of that is Black Friday. How many of you know Black Friday? Right? People will trample over other image bearers of God to get what? Right? 60% off a Paw Patrol tricycle? Right? People will literally trample over other people to get what? A great deal on an Instapot? So when we actually see disordered loves working in people's lives where they're making big deals out of things that aren't really big, we actually get repulsed by that. So Augustine says, don't expect a measure of joy from something that its unique nature cannot provide you. So let me explain it this way. Let's just make it extremely clear. When I was a kid, my brother and I begged my mom and dad for a puppy for Christmas. For like 6 months, we begged every single day. We said, Mom, Dad, we're ready. We're ready for the responsibility. It's 1989. We can do this. We can get a puppy. Look, there's a puppy on Full House. We got to get that one. And we begged my parents. Christmas morning, we run down the stairs. My parents are so sadistic. Let me tell you, there's this big box waiting for us. We rip it open. I am anticipating seeing a puppy. And I pull out 2 pound puppy stuffed animals. Do you remember pound puppies? Anyone here? So we pull out these 2 pound puppies. Christmas of 1989. It broke my heart. This is why I've got trust issues, people. Listen, a pound puppy is pretty cute, but it cannot provide the same joy a real puppy can give you when you love it. Are you with me? So on the scale of being, a pound puppy is one thing, but a real puppy is another thing. There's this picture of this dude, I don't know if you can see it, this guy's smelling an onion and this woman is smelling a baby. Why is he smelling an onion? I don't get it. He's like, he actually looks more in love with the onion than this woman, than her baby. Like, that's just messed up. Everything on that scale of being has its unique nature, and it can provide you with a particular amount of joy when you love it and respond to it rightly. And the danger is that when you expect too much from something that its unique nature it was not meant to give you. If you love things in the wrong way, if you get those loves out of order, loving little things too greatly, loving great things too little, the outflow of your life actually gets distorted. It's like in The Lord of the Rings, right? Gollum, he's got that ring and it's his great joy. What does he call it? His precious. And the more obsessive he comes with when he's staring in that ring, the more obsessed he gets, what happens? The more disfigured he becomes. He actually becomes something that he was never intended to be. So can we actually agree this morning? When we see excessive, disordered loves in people, we're actually repulsed by it, aren't we? If the wrong object of love possesses your heart, your life ends up getting distorted and corrupted. When the wrong things grip you, it actually corrupts your heart. It corrupts you as an individual, and it ends up transforming you into something that God never intended for you to be. Now listen, pornography, look at what pornography has done to men in particular in our culture. I mean, I single out men, not because women aren't susceptible to the clutches of pornography, but the viewing of pornography is so pervasive among men. I read stats from 5 years ago that said men are 543% more likely to look at pornography than women. 543%! How do they come up with these metrics? Listen, according to an article from Bustle.com, In 2016, in just 1 year, people all around the globe spent over 4.5 billion hours watching porn online. 4.5 billion hours in 1 year. Let me put that in perspective to you. According to this article, that is 2.5 times longer than humans have been on the planet. And that is how much time has been spent consuming pornographic material online in 1 year, 2016 alone. That's how much pornography has consumed in 1 year by the global population. You want to talk about disordered loves? Look at what pornography has done to men in particular. It has twisted masculinity, and now many men are completely incapable of giving themselves in covenant love to one woman. But here's how this happens. Pornography has trained men to disdain sameness. Pornography, click after click, another dopamine hit after dopamine hit, a new lover every single time you turn on your computer screen. It cultivates and trains our bodies to be incapable of deep emotional attachment to a single individual. It cultivates this addiction, but unlike drug addiction where you need the same hit from the same drugs, pornography is this real downward spiral of consumption where you're no longer thrilled by the same thing. So there's this constant need to consume more and more and more, more both in variety, more in volume. And it trains you to only crave. It trains you to only crave the excitement and allure of romantic love, but it actually robs you of developing deep emotional attachment to a real person. And we have a culture of young men in our culture right now, who have reduced love to essentially a string of one-night stands or sexual conquests. You want to talk about where rape culture is cultivated? This is where it's cultivated. When your loves are out of order, it starts to twist and corrupt your character. It actually starts to disfigure your humanity. Not only will it corrupt you, but it will crush you. It will disappoint you. It will leave you so disappointed because you expected more from something than its unique nature could provide for you. Listen to what American author David Foster Wallace once said at a commencement speech at Kenyon College. So he's looking over this whole generation of young men and women who are just about to graduate, and this is what he tells them. Now, Foster Wallace was not a professing Christian. In fact, he died tragically of a suicide. And I think he's actually one of our generation's most brilliant authors. Go and read Infinite Jest. It's crazy. He said, everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Listen, there is a right order to things in our lives. There is a supreme love that orders everything else in our life. There is a supreme love that makes sense of everything else on this scale of being. And your joy and your peace and your flourishing depend on you knowing and encountering this supreme love.
And this is what Paul has been saying from chapter 1, hasn't he? This is what Augustine has been talking about. The greatest thing you can love is God as he's revealed himself to you in Jesus. The greatest object of love available to the human heart is Jesus. On that scale of being, Jesus is preeminent. He's head and shoulders above everything else. There's nothing in the universe that you can love that is greater than Jesus, that is purer than Jesus, that is more lovely or more loving than him. And the joy your heart craves is found in relating to him in love and trust and loving him supremely. We must love what is most lovely, and Jesus is the one who's most lovely. He's the one that when he possesses your heart, his love does not corrupt you, his love does not eat you alive, he does not disfigure your humanity. Rather, he enhances you, doesn't he? He makes you even more real, even more substantive, even more lovely, even more righteous, even more pure, even more beautiful. He gives weight and significance and meaning to your life. In other words, he makes you more human. He doesn't drive you like all those other things into fear and shame and insecurity and anger like idols of money or beauty or popularity or intellect do. When you fail all those things, all those lesser masters, they mock you. They ridicule you. They make you feel unlovable and empty. Can I get a witness? But when you fail Jesus, you turn to him and he forgives you. He restores you. He affirms you. He strengthens you. All those other loves require you to spill your blood, sweat, and tears if you're going to have them. Listen, Jesus spilled his blood, his sweat, his tears to possess you. He not only surpasses all things in beauty and power, but he surpasses them all in goodness. He does not corrupt you. He leads you into the most noble and honorable expressions of yourself. He leads you into your highest honor, church. He does not corrupt you. He will not crush you. And so the call is to have your hearts thrilled with him. This is where freedom starts. This is the road of discipleship. This is the one main point I want to make this morning. So if you came in this morning and you're hiding in secret sin and you're addicted to pornography this morning, listen, I got to tell you, you got to embrace, you got to fight for your life. You got to embrace all sorts of methods to overcome all these habits that you've cultivated in your life. So you got to get an online filter. You got to bounce the eyes. You got to get an accountability partner. You got to embrace all those methods. But if you're going to get free, you have to address the deeper issue of your affections. Listen, you can embrace methods and find measures of victory and freedom, but still that feeling, that never-ending pull towards that inner sin will always be there. You have to have that desire expelled from your heart by a greater desire. You have to have that love dethroned by a greater love. You got to get Biebs out of there and you got to bring in Drake. I don't know. Look at what it says in Ephesians 5:8. I know I haven't even really preached on this passage, but this is what Paul says. He says, "For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light." Paul is saying there was such a remarkable encounter you experienced in meeting Jesus that your life went from walking in darkness to now walking in the light. That encountering and knowing Jesus and having your heart happy in him has changed absolutely everything for you. Parents, I want you to look at me. Parents of young kids or teenagers, I want you to look at me. We can't expect our children to gravitate toward a Christian vision of sexuality if they've never experienced the love of God. If they've never experienced the love of God shed abroad in their hearts, we cannot expect them to gravitate towards a Christian vision of sexuality. We can't. It all starts with affection. It starts with encountering this one named Jesus, experiencing his love for you. Listen to how Puritan pastor John Flavel, I call him Flavel Flav. Listen to what John Flavel writes about our need for our hearts to be thrilled with Jesus. This is important. Listen. He says, ecstasy and delight are essential to the believer's soul, and they promote sanctification. We were not meant to live without spiritual exhilaration. And the Christian who goes for a long time without the experience of heartwarming will soon find himself tempted to have his emotions satisfied from earthly things and not as he ought from the Spirit of God. The soul is so constituted. In other words, you were made this way. The soul is so constituted that it craves fulfillment from things outside itself and will embrace earthly joys for satisfaction when it cannot reach spiritual ones. In other words, if your heart is not being thrilled with Jesus, your hearts are going to try to be thrilled with something else. If it's going to find something else on that scale of being and say, satisfy me, thrill me, lead me. The believer is in spiritual danger if he allows himself to go for any length of time without tasting the love of Christ and savoring the felt comforts of a Savior's presence. When Christ ceases to fill the heart with satisfaction, our souls will go in silent search of other loves. By the enjoyment of the love of Christ in the heart of the believer, we mean an experience of the love of God shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Ghost, which is given to us because the Lord has made himself accessible to us in the means of grace. It is our duty and privilege to seek this experience. It's your duty to seek this experience, to have your hearts thrilled with Jesus. From him in all these means till we're made joyful partakers of it. A lot of us know what it means to go in silent search of other lovers. Something along that scale of being that you went after, expecting more from it than its unique nature could provide for you. You went in silent search of other lovers because your heart at the core was not being thrilled in Jesus. Seek to know Jesus because you cannot love what you do not know. And you'll always look suspiciously upon God's commandments if you've never received his love for you. You know, the scriptures say he loved us first. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We know that God loves us and that he loved us first, 1 John 4:19. It starts here at the root of our affections. You must love most what is most lovely. This is why in marriage counseling, as cliche as it sounds, I tell people God actually needs to be the center of this marriage. Because if you're walking into a marriage relationship hoping that your spouse is going to be able to fix all those problems in your life, listen, you're expecting more from your spouse than his or her unique nature can provide you. Listen, if you place that kind of significance and weight upon your spouse to be able to love you perfectly and fix you, if you've said, listen, my problems will go away once I'm in that perfect relationship, you're actually going to break that relationship apart. You must love most what is most lovely. And it's from here everything else on that scale of being begins to actually make sense. When you love most what is most lovely, you're actually able to enjoy everything else on this scale of being without them becoming a master over you and ruling over you and then ultimately disappointing you. So even sexuality and sexual ethics fall on this scale of being. And the call for us as Christians is for us to submit the whole realm of sexuality under the loving lordship of Jesus and to say to him, Jesus, teach us how to live. Jesus, I'm submitting even my strongest heartfelt desires to you and letting you evaluate those desires and letting you lead me into the truest and greatest expressions of myself. Sometimes you have to side with Jesus, even against some of your strongest heartfelt desires. But here's the thing, if you do not love him, if you have not received his love for you, you will never trust him with those strongest heartfelt desires. You must love most what is most lovely, and you must receive the love of the one who loves you most.